Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello.
Hello, could I please speak with Andy Borowitz?
This is he.
Andy, this is Paul, Paul Holdengraber, calling you from The Quarantine Tapes. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Paul?
I am all right. What a day to be speaking to you on. You know, usually I don't mention to our listeners when I'm speaking because I never know when we will air this quarantine tape segment. But I can't not mention that we are speaking on Inauguration Day. And I'm wondering, Andy, what made you laugh today?
What made me laugh today? Well, I think the spectacle of QAnon followers deciding that they were no longer QAnon followers in great numbers. There seemed to be embarrassment. It's like they, for the last 4 years, have been true believers, and they were waiting. I guess the QAnon cult led them to believe that today there would be some sort of Armageddon and Joe Biden would never actually take the oath of office. And it's a little bit like the people who are following the Mayan prophecies that the world would end in 2012, and really none of that happened. And I don't know what happened to those adherents, but I can tell you that on Twitter, at least, and elsewhere, QAnon followers seem extremely disappointed that the end of this pedophile, pro-cannibal cabal, that it didn't come to an end. And apparently we've now, you know, elected our first cannibal president in Joe Biden, and none of the QAnon forces reckoned with that. None of them could do anything to stop his incredible cannibal energy from occupying the White House. So I think that, I think all of us were kind of holding our breath after the really disastrous attempt at a coup from 2 days ago to the date, 2 weeks ago, rather, to the date, January 6th. We were all sort of, you know, worried about maybe some kind of mischief going on today. But the one thing, Paul, that I was a little bit perplexed by is that a lot of the commentators were bemoaning the fact that there were 25,000 troops in Washington, D.C. I loved that they were there, personally. I thought that was a great thing to see. I mean, they were saying that there are more troops in Washington, D.C. than were in Afghanistan and Iraq. And, you know, the reason we sent troops to those countries was to export democracy. Remember that?
I remember. It isn't that far away.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that we necessarily did a fabulous job of exporting democracy. I mean, I guess the Taliban is kind of semi back in charge in Afghanistan. I don't think Iraq, the democracy, is in the top 10 democracies of the world. But as far as I'm concerned, I like the idea of 25,000 troops protecting our democracy. I mean, I think that's the one. Our democracy, Paul, is the one that I use the most often. I use it much more than I use, say, Iraq's democracy. So I like the idea of my tax dollars protecting that democracy. I was perfectly okay with that that site today. And as far as I'm concerned, if we can have some troops keeping those clownish, I was going to call them, you know, QAnon supporters, but I don't know what they're supporting now. If we can keep MAGA Nation, whatever that is, from disrupting the Capitol as they did 2 weeks ago, if it takes some troops, I'm down with that.
Tell me, Andy, what kind of headlines are going through your mind today? I'm sure many are going through your mind, and maybe you can share a few with us that you might not use.
Well, to me, when I saw Biden and I saw the celebration, I mean, the headline that comes to mind, if I could sum up what happened today, it would be something like Biden vows to restore nation to factory settings. I think that's what it was. I think it's interesting if you compare what he was saying to memorable inaugural speeches of the past. And by the way, I think his speech was pretty good.
So did I.
I think that if Neil Kinnock were listening, I think Neil Kinnock might actually plagiarize from Biden's speech. I really do. I think that it was well written. It made some really good points, and it played to his strengths, which, you know, his much touted empathy. That's such a, now it's such a cliche to say that Joe has empathy, but it's true. He's good at that. And honestly, after the last 4 years, empathy seems like an amazing skill to have. It seems like the ability to, I don't know, make a 70-yard field goal or something. It's so such a hard thing for certain presidents to do, or ex-presidents, shall I say. Oh, that doesn't that sound good? I just said ex-president. That sounds amazing. It was devoutly to be wished. But anyway, I thought his speech was good. But, you know, it's interesting. Previous speeches by that we think of when we think of inaugural addresses, you think of like FDR, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. That's very soaring rhetoric. Or you think of JFK saying, you know, we will send a man to the moon and return him safely, if I'm paraphrasing that or whatever. These very, very lofty and ambitious things. And Joe was basically saying, I will make things semi-normal again. And that seemed like the most ambitious, visionary thing that anybody could say. It's like, really? You're going to be able to do that? So to me, it was basically factory settings, folks. Hard reset. The previous guy dropped this phone in the toilet, and I'm going to pull it out of the toilet, dry it out, and do a hard reset.
I was happy to hear him not say this is who we are or this is not who we are, but rather rather acknowledge the fact that who we are is can be embarrassing. And I'm wondering, you know, you did a show called Make America Not Embarrassing Again. Are you not embarrassed yet?
Oh, I think embarrassment, and first of all, I think embarrassment is very human. I think that we, as Americans, should come to terms with the fact that we're always going to have something to be embarrassed for. I mean, you know, we've had we have leaders who do embarrass us, even when we like them. I would say that, you know, one person who I would say in my lifetime never embarrassed me was Barack Obama, because he was the master of self-control. You got the feeling that Barack Obama would never do anything that he would then look back on later and say, oh my gosh, I wish I hadn't done that. He would always stop himself before he uttered something inappropriate or did something inappropriate. And that in itself became, to me, kind of comic, because nobody is that controlled. And yet he was always sort of keeping a lid on it. I will say I'm significantly less embarrassed now that we no longer have a game show host running the country. Yes. I mean, I think it feels good sometimes for people to elect a protest candidate, because they're frustrated with the way government works or doesn't work. And so they say, oh, let's just throw in that guy from The Apprentice. He'll be amazing. He'll just fire a bunch of people. That part they were right about. He did fire a lot of people. But generally speaking, protest candidates really don't pan out, because it feels good in the moment, but it doesn't have legs. And if you look at, for example, the state of Minnesota, they've never elected another professional wrestler as their governor. They did it once. It felt good in the moment. And it's like, maybe we should have some people in government run the government. So, yes, I feel already like the face that we are now presenting to the world, we're going to get back into the Paris Climate Accords, and we're going to start respecting our role in NATO again. But I think that we need to spend some time after the last 4 years, even though I claim no responsibility for the Trump administration since I did everything in my power to oppose it. I think America has to spend a little bit of time in the penalty box. Like, I don't think that we can now start preaching to the world about how democracy should be and how people should comport themselves on the public stage. I think we need at least a few months of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris being dignified role models before we start lecturing the rest of the world again. Because right now, let's face it, Paul, the world would just laugh in our faces if we tried that.
Yeah, we're in so many places around the world, we are, as it were, persona non grata. And I'm wondering, this, you know, dignified role you were mentioning, and I'm sure this kind of a question comes to you so often, does that make your line of work or your line of business harder. I mean, you've said that, you know, Biden will be a fantastic target for comedy. And I'm wondering if you think that now, or with all the events that have happened recently, you might yourself be taking a step back.
Well, it's an interesting question. It's a question that comes up a lot. I, for better or worse, I've been writing the Borowitz Report now for 20 years. If you can imagine that. I just started when George W. Bush was elected president, and when he took office in 2001, 20 years ago. And we had 8 years of Bush and Cheney. And that was a very, very target-rich environment, as the Pentagon would say. I mean, George W. Bush was his hate-hate relationship with the English language really made for, I would say, pretty easy, cheap shots. And when you write a column almost every day, you don't look down your nose at cheap shots. Cheap shots kind of get you through the day. It's not something you might not feel proud of yourself after taking a cheap shot, but you know you're going to do it. And so after 8 years of George W. Bush, we were then faced with this kind of, as I said, master of self-control, Barack Obama. And I remember being on CNN and people asking me, how are you going to make fun of Barack Obama? He's so elegant and self-controlled. He's also our first African-American president, which is so historic. So, you know, that in and of itself is going to demand some respect on your part. Also, and this was just my issue, I happen to agree with him politically. So that would also be kind of challenging. But what happened under Obama, which was very educational for me, was that everybody on the other side acted so insane towards him that that's where the comedy wound up residing. You know, you had John Boehner. I don't know how well you remember him, but John Boehner, who's that strange orange color, the first member of the Orange Party before Trump got in there. But John Boehner and his House Republicans kept on repealing Obamacare, even though they didn't have the votes to do it. So they did it like 75 times. They kept on having these votes to repeal Obamacare, and they behaved insanely. There was the Tea Party, also a bunch of lunatics, kind of pre-QAnon in a way. Like, they were sort of kind of opened the door for QAnon. So the lesson in that, you know, I had one very easy president, George W. Bush, and then a challenging president in Barack Obama, and they were equally fertile years for political satire. And I think the lesson is something that was actually articulated by Will Rogers, the great American political humorist from the early part of the 20th century. He once said famously, and I love this quote, he said, "There's no trick to being a political humorist when you have the whole government working for you." And I think that
oh, that's fantastic.
Sums it up.
That's fantastic. I mean,
yeah, so we've lost Donald Trump, who, and by the way, I want to bust this myth that Donald Trump was a great gift to comedy, because
right.
On the surface it seemed like he was, but really there's this principle in comedy, which is that it's very hard to make a joke about a joke. And somebody who's already so clownish, it was very, very hard to amp that up at all. You know, when you're writing fake news or satirical news the way I do, the whole goal is to take the real news and then sort of elevate it, you know, a few inches above reality. Not wildly exaggerated, but just elevate it slightly. And so
sufficiently.
Yeah. You look at something, you know, you look at Trump and you look at the headlines, and I would try to think of what would be the most ridiculous thing that he could do given the situation. And I would write that story, and then literally within 10 minutes, he would actually do that thing. So my news wasn't really fake anymore. It was just early, and that wasn't really the goal. I wasn't trying to predict. I wasn't trying to be Nostradamus and say, okay, here's the demented thing he's going to actually do. I was just, I was really trying to come up with something satirical. But that was the real trap with Trump, was that satire was very, very difficult, because he essentially was satire proof. He was so clownish. And I think if you're a TV comedian like Trevor Noah or Stephen Colbert, the same rule didn't necessarily apply, because what they would do is they could run some tape of Trump saying something bizarre like a coronavirus briefing, and then cut to a really great deadpan reaction from them. But in writing, it's very different. You don't have that option. You don't have the option of just like a facial, you know, response, you know, a facial expression. You have to somehow pull it off in a literary / verbal way. And so it was tricky. What I wound up sometimes doing was I would just kind of use Trump logic and just try to think, okay, he's lying to us all the time. He's gaslighting us constantly. So why don't I just take him at his word and try to just say what would happen if what Trump was saying was actually true. And so I'll give you an example of that,
because yes,
I know that sounds a little abstract. But this seems like ages ago, and now it almost seems quaint, given the fact that he attempted to overthrow the government 2 weeks ago. But remember when the biggest issue facing Trump was Stormy Daniels?
I do.
Yes. Stephanie Clifford is her actual name. She's her performing name as a thespian is Stormy Daniels. And it came out that Michael D. Cohen, who was Trump's lawyer at the time, had paid Stormy Daniels, I believe, $135,000, I think is the number, to buy her silence. And this emerged and was a pretty big, embarrassing story because, first of all, it may have violated campaign finance laws, but also it pretty much nailed the fact that Trump had sex with this porn star. I just went out and said it. I was dancing around her profession before, but now I'll be a little bit more explicit.
Thank you.
So it was good. I'm glad you appreciate it.
Very much, very much. Call things by their name.
Exactly. So there was just a lot of, at that point, pretty open speculation that Trump had sex with Stormy Daniels. And Michael D. Cohen came out, and in a great example of Trumpian gaslighting, he said, no, Trump didn't have sex with Stormy Daniels. He was afraid that she was going to say she had sex with Trump. And so we paid her $135,000 so that she wouldn't say it. That was the gaslighting they did. So I thought about that for a moment. I thought, well, wait a minute. I also have never had sex with Donald Trump. So where's my $135,000? They should be paying me to keep me from saying it. So
Me too, please.
Well, you're one step ahead of me, Paul, because the story I wrote was, I think the headline was, millions of Americans demand $135,000 for not having sex with Trump. And it was basically people like you or me, men, women, you know, everybody just saying, you know, if they're paying people just to not say that they didn't have sex with them, or, you know, just to keep them quiet, then we should all be paid. And so there was, that's a pretty good example of, you know, what I had to resort to with Trump. He was such a liar, and his lies were so absurd. He already got to the absurd place before satire could. So all I could do was, okay, I would just be like, I would pretend I was the most gullible journalist on the planet. Just take him 100% at face value. Another one was when he would claim that that Russia did not meddle in the election because Vladimir Putin told him that they didn't meddle. And so he thought, well, that's good enough for me. If Putin said he didn't meddle, then obviously I didn't. So I had basically Robert Mueller canceled his investigation based on Putin's evidence because he just said there's a very time-tested practice in law enforcement, which is if a suspect says that they didn't do something, then the case is closed. You just cannot pursue it any further than that. So again, it was like, you know, they're really expecting us to believe this gaslighting reality. So I'm personally very happy that the gaslighting is over, because I think what we're also seeing is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, based on, you know, the guy, the QAnon shaman and everybody else running into the Capitol 2 weeks ago, a lot of people unfortunately fell for it. So it was, on a not so light note, it was pretty damaging. It'll be nice to see whether like a few, I don't expect Joe Biden to be 100% truthful because no politician is, but, you know, compared to Trump, I mean, come on, it's going to be like he's been administered sodium pentothal or something.
You know, the way you just described some of the headlines you came up with made me really think of this quotation you so much love, I know, of Mark Twain, where he says, "There's nothing funnier than the truth stated nakedly." And also, Twain came to my mind when you were talking about predictions. I always loved his line that it's really hard to make predictions, especially about the future.
That's a great one. His maxims, axioms really do. It's amazing how timeless they are. And it's a lot like his writing in general. Like, you know, the best of Mark Twain is that it's so simple and so kind of unembellished that it really, it reaches us across the centuries, which is so unusual for any form of writing, but especially for comedy writing, because comedy writing, and mine especially, has such a brief shelf life, because we're writing about the way we're living now and the things that are happening now, and we're writing in a vernacular that's of the moment. And so there's very little hope for our stuff lasting. But Mark Twain, somehow, he's just had this freakish, I guess genius is the only way you can describe it, of, there are few writers like that, you know, Shakespeare, Mark Twain. Not there isn't a long list.
Well, you know, but here is a serious question in a sense, which is that your work is very time sensitive, very timely, and partly the reason I asked you what headlines might be going on in your head today on Inauguration Day is precisely to tap into that timely aspect of your work. And yet, I sometimes wonder, Andy, do you sometimes wish there was something less time sensitive in your work? And I'm thinking here of an example of a comic who I think you probably enjoy as much as I do, which is George Carlin. And George Carlin, you know, it was certainly of a period, but listening to him now or reading him now, it still is so pungent.
Well, he's in sort of in that Mark Twain category. I actually did an anthology for the Library of America about 10 years ago, actually, called The 50 Funniest American Writers. And it was that title was really chosen just to piss people off, because whenever you do a best of list, you know, and you rank people, it always annoys people because they say, well, why wasn't this person included? Often it's people saying, why wasn't I included? Which really annoys people. Like they thought they should have been on the list. It was kind of a marketing gimmick to call it that. But George Carlin, obviously, he is in that Twain category, because he had that. And I think Will Rogers, who's been kind of forgotten, unfortunately, maybe he'll have a revival since I keep quoting him. He is also in that category where a lot of his stuff really does hold up, and it is timeless. But I mean, one thing that I always quote from George Carlin, and then I'll get back to your question of, do I wish I were like George Carlin? The answer is yes, of course. I also wish I were Mark Twain and William Shakespeare, by the way. And I also kind of wish I were J-Lo. She was amazing today.
And that you got the $135,000. I mean, we wish a lot of things.
So many things. You got to kind of, you know, deal with the hand that you're dealt. And I am not George Carlin. Let me put it this way. I'm now highly evolved enough that I don't spend a lot of time bemoaning the fact that I'm not George Carlin. I just spend my time enjoying George Carlin. But here is a great line of his, which is so true, and I'm probably mangling it. But he said that the way we should choose our presidents is that you should ask people if they want to be president, and if they say yes, they're immediately disqualified. And I think that is, you know, that pretty much in a nutshell sums up. Now, I know that we have just elected a president who kept trying to be president for about 40 years. So
right.
I think by George Carlin's rule, I'm sure Joe Biden would be disqualified. But the fact is, I don't need to explain his joke. I think his joke is as clear as it can be. But
I'll never forget when we did a tribute to George Carlin at the New York Public Library where I used to work. His daughter came on stage to say that never ever had her father been as happy as when the 7 Supreme Court justices had to repeat ad nauseum the 7 words you can never say on the radio or on television. He took such pride and delight. Anyway, I interrupted you. Forgive me.
No. He's a genius, and he you know, certainly holds up. And you know, unlike Mark Twain, we have the benefit of also being able to see him perform.
That's right.
It's eternal, which is just an amazing thing. I mean, Will Rogers kind of predated YouTube and all of our various archival systems. I don't know what exists, if there's like some recordings. I've actually heard very little of him. I don't know if I've ever heard his voice. I've just read his writing. But he had a line where he said, I said, I'm not the member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat, which I also thought was, you know, it's, again, I was thinking about that today because I felt like, man, the Democrats really got their act together this year. I mean, they coalesced around the most electable candidate. They, you know, put forth a really well-produced pandemic-era convention. Today, I thought that everything, I used to be a TV producer in an earlier life, and I just thought everything they did from a staging point of view was perfect. I mean, it was just so well done.
Yes.
And also Joe Biden, this version, this, I don't know, Joe Biden 6.0, 7.0, I don't know which version this is, but this is the best Joe Biden we've ever had, because Joe Biden in an earlier incarnation, like in the 80s and 90s, was in fact a really great target for comedy because he was so undisciplined. I mean, he was just, once you put a microphone in front of him, anything could happen. And they've kept Joe Biden in general down to a diet of about 200 words a day.
Right.
And I think as long as they keep that up, this is the best Joe Biden anyone could ever dream of. He's really...
In a way, what you're saying is if only they can make sure that Joe Biden doesn't speak too much, will be okay. You know, I must say, Andy, two of your headlines recently, which was part of the reason I really wanted to talk to you now, and as it so happens, we're talking on this ominous day, the two very recent Borowitz reports that I loved, both of them about the second act, was the one where you say, Fauci says immunity for Trump requires two doses of impeachment. And then the other one, which I loved even more, is majority of Americans say this is their favorite impeachment of Trump. That was January 12th, and I love the sequel was more popular than the original. That's right. Cracked me up, I must say.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, it is a sequel. It's like, this is like the Godfather 2. Godfather 2 was widely, got more Oscars than Godfather 1. And the key is to quit while you're ahead. I don't think that Godfather 3 was terrible. So I think this probably should be, as much as I would love to keep impeaching Trump, I think we should probably quit after the second one. That's my feeling. It's like the Rocky movies, you know.
Right.
Rocky movies, there were diminishing returns. And I just feel like the guy I feel bad for, who's a really good guy and really good congressman, is Adam Schiff, because poor Adam Schiff, like, he had to, you know, prosecute an impeachment trial where they had to explain what all this stuff in the Ukraine was about. In Ukraine, you see, I even didn't even say the country right. You know, they kept on slipping and saying the Ukraine when it's simply Ukraine. So that's a problem right there. And then they had to explain that it was a quid pro quo. So they're speaking in a dead language to the American people, many of whom don't even speak English that well. And you're explaining to them a Latin term. So I felt like he was really behind the eight ball. I think he's going to be watching the second impeachment, or impeachment part two, and he's going to be saying, man, if only I had this material. If only I had Rudy Giuliani's and Mo Brooks and Trump inciting rioters, and then footage from some of which is from my employer, the New Yorker magazine, you know, footage of people like ransacking the place where the trial is being held.
Yeah,
I mean, that is on top of everything else, that's very meta. That's very postmodern.
That's right. That video that the New Yorker did was truly extraordinary and chilling. Andy, do you ever feel really, really misunderstood? And if so, how so? I mean, I know that you've put on the Borowitz report on the New Yorker site, not the news, but that doesn't always help.
No, I mean, this is also, by the way, it's an issue that I've dealt with. I mean, there is a website you might be familiar with called Snopes.com, is dedicated to myth busting, and they will say whether something is real news or fake news, or sometimes they will say satire. And I'm very grateful that that's what happens when people misunderstand a story of mine. I did a story about our late lamented education secretary, Betsy DeVos, who is a favorite target of mine because she was an education secretary and she was also the dumbest person in the country. So she seemed miscast in that role as far as I was concerned, just my opinion. But I did a headline which was Betsy DeVos says that Trump's 40% approval rating means more than half the country supports him. And this got very widely shared. I mean, I think partially one phenomenon I've noticed, and this goes back over the 20 years I've done this column, is that sometimes the stories that really convince people that they're true are when they're about people that you already have kind of a low opinion of. So it's, I guess, a form of confirmation bias. So if you already think Betsy DeVos is a dope because at her confirmation, she said that we should have guns in classrooms because bears might attack. I mean, she actually said that. So if that's what you know about Betsy DeVos, the fact that she would maybe have a problem understanding that 40% was not more than half wouldn't surprise you and say, holy cow, she said that. And so in general, that kind of confirmation bias kicks in and some of our critical faculties are suspended. And that's why it's very handy that an organization like Snopes.com comes in and says, no, that was satire once again. I am misunderstood despite the many very, very overt, blatant labelings that we apply to the column indicating that they're satirical. But once again, if I can peel back the mists of time, I think I just did a mixed metaphor. You'll forgive me.
Okay.
I don't know what you do with mists. if you roll them back, mists can roll back, I guess. So we roll back the mists of time. One of the most famous pieces of satire, and I'm sure you are well-versed in this, as are many of our listeners. I'm sure since they listen to you, they're very highly educated. One of the most famous piece of satire ever written was A Modest Proposal by Jonathan Swift, from the 18th century. And it was an essay written very deadpan in the style that, you know, I adopt and The Onion adopts and every other person writing satire tends to. The more serious, the better in general for satire to work. And he was making what he called a modest proposal, which was the best way to solve the hunger problem among the poor was to let them eat their children. And he stated this proposal in a very sober way. And this caused tremendous outrage. Everyone believed that he was making this proposal seriously, including the Queen of England. So the problem of satire being misunderstood is actually as old as satire. It's not, people sometimes will say, oh, this is a problem with social media and everybody wants to crack down on social media. Social media has its problems, but the fact that people don't get satire is not social media's problem. That's the problem with us. That's the problem with readers and the audience and our lack of critical thinking. And I think we can beat up on Mark Zuckerberg for so many things, but I don't think we can lay this one at his feet.
You know, if we had time, world enough and time, I would ask you about your leaving Twitter and how different it is for you to have left Twitter to save your marriage than for Trump to have left Twitter and feeling that he has really nothing else to do, at least in the last days of his presidency. But instead of that, since you mentioned Swift, few people, I think, would know that you have an interest in restoration drama, and few people.
Oh my gosh!
And few people would know probably that Hobbes mattered to you greatly, and that you came up. You quoted this line where he says, "We laugh out of a sense of sudden glory," which brought me to a much more current thinker who's incredibly important now for all of us, who's Hannah Arendt, who said that laughter is a form of self-sovereignty, and I'm wondering how that resonates with you.
Gosh, I had never heard that quote, but that's a brilliant quote. And and Twain, actually, since we're quoting all of our favorites, yes, all our favorite comedians, George Carlin, Hannah Arendt, I mean, all of the real funny people out there.
I can give you a few more. For instance, Thomas Bernhard said, "Whoever can't laugh doesn't deserve to be taken seriously." But anyway, go on.
Well, Well, I mean, Twain, I mean, sort of related to what she said, what Arendt said, was that, you know, Twain had this theory that, I'm misquoting it, but it's sort of like, against the force of laughter, nothing can stand. And it's sort of about the power of mockery, that mockery actually can, you know, topple dictators is a little strong. But it actually, it's just interesting when, you know, the statues of Saddam came down, people were like throwing their shoes at the statues, the ultimate sign of disrespect. And it's kind of a comic takedown to throw your shoe at somebody. You know, I know in that part of the world it has particular power and symbolism. But, I must congratulate you or your staff on the incredible deep dive you did into my past, to find out that I wrote my senior thesis in college about Restoration comedy. And for those who are not familiar with Restoration comedy, let me just quickly suggest...
There are only a few people who are not.
Yeah, okay, good. Wikipedia is going to give you a good guide to it. But basically, I was thinking, Paul, coincidentally, and I will answer your question, I was thinking today about the Restoration, because in fact, today was a Restoration. It's like we had 4 years of Looney Tunes.
Right.
We had 4 years of absolute anarchy and kleptocracy, and today was a restoration. And the restoration in England was 1660, when Charles II took the throne. And this came after almost the opposite of what we just had. It was after the Puritans were in charge, and they had closed down the theaters, and they'd gotten rid of comedy, and they'd gotten rid of any kind of lewdness and dancing and everything that's fun about life. Sort of like what coronavirus has done to New York City and LA and places like that. But leaving that aside, Charles II came in, and suddenly the theaters were open, life got fun again, and life got lewder than it ever was. I mean, people were just behaving in this totally licentious way. So naturally, when I had to write a senior thesis, this was the period of drama that I was interested in writing about. Because everybody in, you know, college wants to write about Shakespeare, or maybe even Jacobean drama, or you write about like the great 18th century dramatist. But in my case, I sort of picked the one area that was really kind of the bald-headed stepchild of English literature, because the Restoration is considered just very bawdy and kind of low and not worthy of scholarly interest, which is why when I had to take my honors orals, none of the professors who were my inquisitors actually knew that much about Restoration comedy, which I must say was very much by design on my part. I thought, well, I'm going to choose an area that really there's no one on the faculty that's a super, because you don't want to be grilled by somebody who won, say, a Nobel Prize for their book about Samuel Johnson, for example. You don't want that as your inquisitor. So I chose this intentionally obscure theme, and I wrote about this this writer named Sir George Etheridge, who only wrote three plays. Again, by design, I can handle that reading list. But what I came upon in my desire to kind of come up with a somewhat easy topic and an enjoyable topic, I did learn that the Restoration comedians, these wits who gathered around Charles II's court, they were all super into Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, which a lot of us also have had on various college reading lists. And, you know, this, it's a great tract about government and society and all that. But the part that interested them and interested me was his whole theory of laughter. And he boiled it down to that line that you quoted, which was that laughter is this kind of involuntary reaction of what he called sudden glory, which is we suddenly perceive ourselves as superior to the thing that we're laughing at.
Right.
And it really holds up, even when a guy like a great comedian, like, I don't know how familiar you are with Jim Gaffigan and his comedy, but Jim is the master at, you know, self-deprecating comedy, which is kind of, self-deprecating sounds kind of nerdy and nebbishy, and that's not all what he does. He makes fun of himself in this kind of savage way. And it's true that we see ourselves in Jim and we relate to Jim, but we also, in a way, when he does this, we have this shock of recognition. And the shock of recognition in and of itself is a form of glory. It's like, oh, aren't I smart? I get exactly what he's saying. And that feeling of getting a joke,
right,
is an adrenaline rush, and it's savage. It's like, you know, it's like you're an animal, like a wolf baring your teeth, and that's why you smile. I know that gets
But it's interesting because the opposite is also so interesting to think about, which is what it feels like not to get a joke.
Oh, it's terrible. I remember I did a show at Symphony Hall in Boston a couple of years ago, and I was doing a Q&A, and I remember I did a joke that I would put it this way: it would be very helpful to be Jewish to get this joke. And there were enough people in the audience who were either Jewish or who got the Jewish reference that the joke did incredibly well. And somebody who was, the spouse of somebody new in the audience, who was not Jewish and did not get the joke at all, was, I would say, not just, it wasn't that he didn't laugh, it was that he was so upset that everybody else laughed.
Right.
So it's like this feeling of like, oh my God, there are all these laughing, I'm surrounded by laughing hyenas, and I feel disempowered that I didn't get the joke. I would say that one of my favorite moments, there's only one moment of Trump's presidency where I liked him. You might be the first person that I've confessed this to, but there was one moment of vulnerability that he showed that in a way was almost poignant. And I'll tell you what it was. It was when he made his very first address to the United Nations General Assembly. And in a comic sense, a comedian sense, he didn't really gauge the room properly. And so he got up there, and instead of making a statesman-like address, he just got up there and did what he always did, which was he just touted all of his achievements, which mainly were in his own mind. They weren't things he'd actually accomplished, but he rattled off all these things that he thought he had done. And he said, you know, based on everything that I've done thus far, I think we'd all agree that this has been the most successful presidency in the history of the United States. I'm paraphrasing. You're already laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so did the entire UN General Assembly. So, he got this enormous unintentional laugh, and the look on his face was fascinating, because at first there was a look of shock. He was like, wait a minute, that was supposed to be an applause line. Why are they laughing? And then there was this kind of, I would say, sort of a sad look of like, oh my God, they're laughing. I don't really get why they're laughing. But then that broke into kind of, I would say, almost a childlike smile of happiness. And he said, his reaction was, well, that wasn't the reaction I was going for, but I'll take it.
Fantastic. But it's so interesting, because in a way, your example works perfectly as not having a sense of sudden glory.
Right. Just the opposite.
It's exactly the opposite. And I thought that, you know, reading that Hobbes line, it really made me think. And it made me think of this wonderful line of Lawrence Durrell, with which we can close, Andy, where he says, like all young men, I set out to be a genius, but mirthfully laughter intervened.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. That's fantastic. That's something that I guess everybody who looks at the world from a comic point of view loves to embrace the idea. You know, so much of that's a great quote to end on. And I would say, I will never say that thing about laughter is the best medicine, because I actually think Prozac and a whole bunch of other things probably do it better on the whole thing. And I also think these vaccines sound amazing, so I'm not going to put laughter up there. But I do think, given what we've been through in the last 4 years, it was helpful. It was helpful. It was, for me, that's my job and my only response to the nightmares and the depredations that the country and the world suffered as a result of this guy and his enablers. We should not leave them off the hook. His Vichy government, the depredations that everybody suffered through. The fact that we were at moments at least able to mock it really was essential to survival. I know that sounds over the top, but I think it's kind of true.
Andy, what a pleasure and a delight to talk to you on inauguration day. I hope that your subject will remain very, very full of fabulous headlines you will come up with. I wonder if you will grace us with a headline today or tomorrow soon. I can't wait to read you. But I really thank you so much for taking the time. It's been a real pleasure, actually a delight.
Well, thank you, Paul. It was such a pleasure to be part of these tapes.
Thank you. Take good care, and I hope when we can, we can see each other once we've taken the second dose.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.